Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to another edition of Short Attention Span Theater with Zendetti T, William Andrews Herman. Today I'm lucky enough to have a guest on, Robert Peet. He's author of the book Sisyphus Shrug, and he's done a recent critique of Jay Sizemore, the poet who shall not be named, the poet everyone loves to hate. We'll be talking with him. And Robert, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being on. And I think it's a very important topic for us today, censorship in America's press. Tell me a little bit about how you found out to know about Jay Sizemore.
Well, he was just another one of my Facebook friends until about 2 months ago. And so I knew about as much of him as I do of all my other Facebook friends who are writers and poets. And so, you know, if I see somebody who's a writer or poet, I'm more inclined to accept a request or send them a request. And I didn't really think too much about it. But then I saw on his page that he was going through all this stuff, and I just, you know, looked at it and read comments by a lot of different people, and it quickly became apparent to me that a lot of people were really upset, but they didn't really have much evidence or information to back it up. So they were alleging all these things, and they were very upset, but the more I looked at his work and saw his responses, the more I felt that they were more upset than they needed to be or should be, because I didn't interpret what I was seeing from him the same way.
According to some of his critics, he's a demon, he's a misogynist, he's a child molester. Well, I don't know if he's got that charge against him yet, but he is the poet that everyone loves to hate right now. And I really think that criticism is unfair. And I was really impressed by your review of his book, Censored, which came out recently. And can you tell me a little bit about that, how that came about?
Well, you know, I just thought these other people were misunderstanding his work so much that I felt the need to write my interpretation and offer what I thought was really going on in his work. And what was funny was I posted the review last Saturday, and Jay asked me to make it public so that he could share it, and I said, okay, fine. And so then I immediately had a lot of people coming over to my page just to attack me and him without even responding to what he wrote or what I said about it. So it just seems to be this irrational, angry mob from Frankenstein, you know?
You know, I thought we had settled, you know, censorship with what was the last censorship trial? It was Allen Ginsberg and Howell, you know, and that was back in the 60s. And here we are, this is 2017, and it's all over again, you know.
Right.
People, you know, he's gotten death threats, you know, physical harm threats, you know. What's the latest thing that's circulating Facebook? He's moving to Portland, and evidently he's recruited you.
Which is kind of funny, since his critics really are the ones who recruited me. This week he apologized to me for all the stuff that happened after I reviewed him, and I said, no need to apologize, because it was all that stuff that drew me in and made me want to defend him. If anything, they have themselves to thank, because I can't just sit idly by and see somebody suffering false accusations. This guy hasn't done anything warranting these charges. It's just ridiculous. Today I got his book, Mein Trump, in the mail, which is a book of poetry he wrote criticizing Trump. And I just quickly flipped through it, and I flipped through it and I saw that he's got, you know, some pretty strong language in there too. So apparently nobody minds strong language against Trump or other topics. It's just, you know, who he's directing it at that makes people upset. I'm sure, you know, nobody would agree that he's an evil guy for criticizing Trump, but suddenly if you criticize women, then you're an evil jerk.
Yeah, it's really metastasized to something beyond what it should be, I think. You know, he's had some petty squabbles with some of the, I don't know what to call them, it's a poetry cobble, it seems, on Facebook, and he's directed his anger at some of the members of this group, and some of that I think was evident in his book Censored, and it just, can we not use the word satire? Can we not use satire anymore? Is satirical language and satirical poetry out of bounds these days? Are we that politically correct that we can't use sarcasm?
Okay, two things. One, apparently this new series of poems of his was written because of the response he received to Scowl 2 years ago. And, you know, a lot of people attacked him for that. And I haven't even read that yet, so I don't know, you know, what that's about. He's got a little bit of it at the back of Censored. I haven't read it yet. But the point is, he felt attacked over Scowl. He responded with some poems defending himself or criticizing his critics. And then they, you know, howled with even more rage because he dared to stand up for himself and criticize them, which, by the way, he has the perfect right to do. And, you know, so what if his poems are directed at certain people? They say they felt threatened. I mean, really? They're threatened by someone criticizing them? What sort of standard of maturity and adulthood do they live by? I'm from New York. I'm a big boy. I can take criticism. I've had death threats too. I mean, if you put yourself out there on the internet, you're going to face all sorts of stuff from all sorts of people. And if you know that this guy writes pretty strong poetry and you criticize him, really, why are you surprised that he's criticizing you back?
It's really so blown out of proportion. He got banned from Facebook. He got banned from Instagram. He got banned from Twitter. He got banned from Goodreads. I mean, it just blows my mind that in the year 2017, almost 2018, that we can have this kind of bullshit go on still. I read your critique of Censored, and I really thought it was so on point and so good that I just had to have you on this show. Can you explain a little bit more about what your reaction was to his book Censored?
Well, as you saw, I wrote my responses to the first few poems. I've been reading it again today. I've read several more of the poems today. And, you know, he does write some poems that are directly critical of certain people, I'm sure. He does write some poems in which some bad things happen to people who either, you know, represent his critics in general or who were inspired by certain people. But whatever. The point is, poets write poems about people. You know,
right.
I guess if he wrote love poems about somebody, nobody would get upset, or you never know, because people get upset by anything. But, you know, apparently people just can't handle being criticized or fantasized about, because, I mean, I think their real complaint is that they just want him to shut up. We all have violent fantasies. We have all been angry at people and imagined either doing them harm or seeing harm come to them. My mother,
right.
every day, my mother hates Donald Trump, and every day she just talks about how she wishes something bad would happen to him. Now, is she going to go out and risk Secret Service attention? No, she's a law-abiding citizen. But we get angry at people, and we just say, boy, I'd really like to, you know, see something happen to them. The only difference is this guy, Jay Sizemore, wrote it down. And
right.
apparently some people just can't handle the fact that somebody wrote down what he thinks when attacked by them. And they have the nerve to get upset? What do they expect? Are these grown-ups?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they're grown-up or not.
But we seem to live in a society in which everyone seems to think that they have the right not to ever get upset by anything. And it's not just be offended. It's even hear anything unpleasant. I mean, or you could say that they're just taking offense where there is no offense. The point is, we live in a society with freedom of speech, and George Orwell said that freedom of speech means nothing if it doesn't mean the right to say things that people don't want to hear, because the things that they do want to hear will never be threatened. So freedom of speech means the freedom to say things people don't want to hear. And we all have that freedom. But as Jay has said repeatedly, if you don't like my poetry, don't read it.
Don't read it. Don't read it. He comes up with some really, when you look at Jay and his whole body of work, I've got several books by him, and I keep up with him on his Facebook page. You know, he wrote a fantastic poem about suicide prevention. He wrote a fantastic poem about Charles Manson's death. I mean, I take these poems and I go to open mic nights, and as long as I don't talk about who wrote the poem, they're very well received. Well received. But you mentioned the name Jay Sizemore, and oh my God, fuck that. You know, it really bothers me, because I really see Jay as a talent. I really think
he's got
talent.
Yeah, he does.
And to have people, you know, there was something circulating, oh my gosh, here's a poet that's moving to Portland, Oregon, and he's violent against women and blah blah blah, and warning the public against this supposed public threat, and I don't see that he poses a threat to anybody. Pardon me?
No, I'm sorry. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Oh, well, this week somebody told me that his poems constituted violence and that he advocated violence. Well, neither of those charges strikes me as true based on anything I've seen. I'm not sure that a poem can be considered violence, but, you know, he definitely is not advocating violence. He's writing poems in a fictional persona. You could call the poems a combination of horror and satire. And that's another thing I wanted to say about satire. People have this idea that satire is meant to be playful, like Jonathan Swift or Monty Python. Okay, that's one form of satire. There are many forms.
Right.
And he happens to use a brooding, dark, serious persona to add to the satirical effect to show that it's wrong. I mean, his whole thing is to portray the evil of the patriarchy and the menace as a way to illustrate how wrong it is. And to those who have alleged that he didn't announce his work was satire, yes, he did. He said this week that he, in fact, did announce that they were satire when he first released them. So all these people saying that he tricked people or, you know, did anything nefarious, I just think that's all made up.
It's just been blown out of proportion. And it's
well,
it's,
I mean, he writes disturbing
beyond sublime.
Poems. Yeah, I agree. It is absurd and beyond the absurd into the sublime. His poems are disturbing. He uses violent graphic imagery, but, you know, so do other writers.
Yeah.
Dante wrote a great poem about hell. I don't know if you've read it.
Yeah. Definitely have.
But this one,
so,
my favorite one so far that I've read is this one called Immaculate Ejaculation, in which, I mean, I think that, as I said in the review, most people don't get past the first two stanzas because it's first person and it's kind of scary in the persona. But once you get past the first two stanzas, if you don't like that, then it gets to a description of this dystopian patriarchal society in which women's bodies are dismembered and their body parts are used to make this gigantic masturbation machine for men. So it's just a description of how women are dehumanized and used and abused for the pleasure of the patriarchy. He's essentially taking the Taliban and twisting it into a nightmarish Lovecraftian kind of vision, which I think is brilliant. And, you know, he's criticizing the patriarchy. He's saying this is what the patriarchy does to women. Why wouldn't you want somebody to criticize the patriarchy by pointing out what it does to women? Except
He's
very graphic about it, and people, for some reason, can't get past the imagery to realize the meaning of the work itself.
Well, it's been all over Facebook. It's just everywhere now, and it's just, I really appreciate you coming on and defending Jay Sizemore. I had Jay Sizemore on as a guest once before, and he tried to explain this whole situation, and it's just gotten worse. I mean, it's just snowballed into something bigger than it should be.
People like to get upset, you know. It distracts them from their daily lives. It's entertainment, really.
I guess it is, but I don't like the extremes that these secret poetry societies and on Facebook have taken it to. You know, how they can blackball a poet. You know, in this day and age, how I mean, it's political correctness taken to the extreme. In my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. And the question arises: who do they think they are? Are they the arbiters of decency and taste? Are they applying scarlet letters to Jay Sizemore? Are they ostracizing anyone who defends intellectual freedom? And the answer is yes, they are. Because when someone said to me that I, by reviewing and defending him, was trolling the lit community, I thought, wow, that's kind of hilarious. Is this the Borg? I don't know. But the thing is, I responded saying that I was a member of the lit community. I'm a lifelong writer and artist myself. Is there some, you know, gatekeeper on who gets to be a member of a literature community? But the response I got was that, no, I was not a member of the lit community. I was only a member of the Jay Sizemore fan club. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, that would be laughable, and it is laughable, but it's also a frightening attempt at intellectual tyranny. So are you telling me that I'm not a writer? Are you telling me that I'm not a member of the global community of writers and artists? Is there some entrance fee? Obviously, there are people who think that they get to pass judgment and decide who qualifies as a, quote, member of the lit community. Wow.
Well, I wanted to get to, I want to take a musical break here, and I wanted to get some of the other things that I wanted to talk to you about, specifically your book, Sisyphus Shrugged. I'm really glad that you have taken the time to talk to me about Jay Sizemore. I only wish the best for him. He's moving from Nashville to Portland. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but he's moving. He's looking to start a new life, and I only wish him the best.
And I live in Portland, so I'm hoping to meet him soon.
I hope you do. He's one of my favorite poets. We're gonna have a quick musical break with the mayor, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Robert Pete again. We'll be talking about his book and what qualifies him as a member of the literary community in Facebook. Okay.
Yes,
here we go with the mayor. Hang on. Okay, enough of that. I just needed some kind of transition. Okay, we're back with Robert Pete. He is a defender of Jay Sizemore, not a friend, a defender of Jay Sizemore. But more than that, he's got his own book out now. It's called Sisyphus Shrugged. It's kind of a response, sort of a rebuttal to Ayn Rand. Robert, why don't you tell me a little bit about your book?
Okay, well, in 2012, I was really scared by Mitt Romney. I thought if he got elected, we'd see this total right-wing, you know, capitalist wet dream of no taxes, no regulations, no social programs, essentially what we're seeing now with Trump. And so I had heard of Ayn Rand for decades and always with this, you know, very intimidating reputation. And I decided it was time to turn my attention toward her. And I did. And I read her work, Atlas Shrugged. And while I was reading it at the same time, I wrote a sequel slash rebuttal entitled Sisyphus Shrugged, because I felt that Sisyphus symbolized the pointless toil of the worker, you know, rolling the boulder
exactly.
up the hill endlessly,
sure.
and that was the perfect image to contrast. And so in my book, I asked, what if workers went on strike? What if 3/4 of American labor didn't show up tomorrow? Who's truly indispensable here? And would the genius men of the mind be able to get it all done without labor? And obviously my answer is no. So
no.
I picked up her story where she left off at the end of her book, and I continued it. So it starts with the right wing, you know, fantasy of no government, essentially. And then in my story, labor goes on strike, demands liberal reforms, and gets them. So the end, happy ending. That's the book in a nutshell.
In a nutshell. Well, you know, let's talk about Rand and some of her philosophy and how that led you to your own exploration of an extension of her book. You know, she was
sure.
She was pretty down on a lot of things and was. Well, why don't you give me your take on her and her philosophy?
The nutshell about Rand, which even a lot of her supporters deny, is that her work, her lifelong project, was against the Soviet Union. She was born in the Soviet Union. She observed the Russian Revolution firsthand. Her father was a pharmacist. The Russian government took his pharmacy away, took their apartment away, gave it to other people. She was kicked out of university because her family had been bourgeois. Some visiting scientists from another country objected to them kicking out these students, and so they were reinstated. But Rand, as soon as she could, escaped the Soviet Union. So I respect the fact that she knew firsthand the abuse of overbearing government. The problem is when she got to America, she saw communist totalitarian dictatorship everywhere she looked. And she thought
right.
that liberals here, she thought that liberals here were secretly communists trying to oppress everybody. She thought that FDR was going to be another Stalin. And yes, she spends her life talking about how the communists were liars. You know, they only pretended to care about the workers and they just did what they wanted for themselves. But she didn't realize that the liberals here actually mean what they say and tell the truth and want to use government to help people. She didn't believe that. She was fundamentally paranoid and cynical because of the trauma and abuse she had suffered when she was young. I understand that. I forgive her. The problem is that she wrote these stories depicting American liberals as evil communists, and now far too many people take far too much of her work far too seriously and equate the liberals here with communist dictatorship. It's horrible, and I felt that her book had caused enough harm that it was in desperate need of a rebuttal. A lot of liberals dismiss her, they hate her, they don't take her seriously, they don't realize how many people are influenced by her. So I felt that I would take one for the team, essentially, read her entire work, respond to all of her serious points seriously and fairly to give our side the ammunition to say, she's wrong, here's why, in the context
right.
of an entertaining story.
Right, and she developed, you know, a philosophical system that she called objectivism. And,
yep.
you know, advocated reason as the only means of acquiring knowledge, rejected faith and religion. She supported rational ethical egotism and rejected altruism. And, you know, she was really critical of most philosophers and most philosophical traditions known to her. And
that's true.
It's what's scary is that she's been a significant influence among libertarians and American conservatives. Rand Paul.
Well, that's
Go ahead.
Well, that's one of the funny things about her is that she's actually a more eloquent spokesperson for the Republican Party than the Republican Party has ever been in my lifetime. I think that, you know, if they're looking for eloquence, they should start quoting her more. The problem is that what she's saying is wrong. She refers to reason and altruism, but she only refers to them as she defines them. And she does not support her definitions for anything beyond I say so, because I said
right.
So. So you have to read it and agree with her, because if you disagree with her, you're automatically wrong and evil to boot. So, you know, it's like any other cult. You either agree with the cult leader or you are an enemy.
That's my dog. Sorry about that. So what's your central argument for her?
For her? Well, she said that we should stand up for ourselves, and I agree. We should stand up for ourselves. The difference is that I think that we can care about ourselves and other people at the same time.
Right. Right.
So I think she was half right. She emphasizes individualism because she's reacting to communist totalitarian dictatorship. She's rebelling. And, you know, she swung so far in the opposite direction that she's really a tragic figure, because she couldn't trust anyone. She was very lonely. She couldn't really love because she couldn't open up. And, you know, she was a total control freak. So, you know, I feel sorry for her, to be honest. I just think that, you know, we need a philosophy that says, you can't help other people until you help yourself, but as long as you're helping other people, then it's okay to help yourself. I don't want anybody to be
right.
poor or miserable. I want people to be self-actualized and take care of themselves, but also realize that we need other people. One of the big ideas in Sisyphus Shrugged is that we actually need other people, and we need to need them. It's a part of human psychology when we're born to need other people. She has a really hard time admitting that children need their parents, lovers need each other, human beings need each other. There's a phrase in medicine called failure to thrive. If we don't get the love and affection that we need, we fail to thrive. And, you know, I just see her as a stunted individual because she was incapable of love due to the trauma she suffered.
Well, she was definitely a conflicted individual, and you know, a lot of her ideas have kind of come to pass in the recent political climate. A lot of what she said and what she advocated for, it seems that some of our leaders, Rand Paul, Paul Ryan, seem to take it, you know, hook, line, and sinker. And, you know, what can we do about that? That's my question to you. What can we do about that?
Two things. One, education. I mean, your program, my writing, everything we do that promotes thought and reason and logic and morality is fighting that. Right now, you and I are fighting that. But the other thing I want to say about Rand Paul and Paul Ryan is they pay lip service to her, but she would have despised them because, on the one hand, they only take half of her. They cut the taxes and regulations and social programs, but she was completely opposed to government favoring business. She was not a hypocrite. She favored a completely free sink-or-swim market. So businesses rise or fall completely on their own merit without any government tax breaks, subsidies, or other support. She opposed Ronald Reagan because she said he was not a real conservative. He wanted to coddle big business using the power of government. She was completely opposed to that. Now that I've said that, what do you think she would think about Paul Ryan and Rand Paul?
Yeah.
They're hypocrites. They're liars. They pay lip service to anything that serves their agenda. The one thing that Ayn Rand fans never talk about is the fact that in Atlas Shrugged, she crucifies business leaders who are cozy with the government and the government that is cozy with big business. They don't want to talk about that. They are Randian villains. Paul Ryan and Rand Paul are equivalent to villains in her work.
I tell you what, this is a topic that I'd like to revisit at a future date. Let me just say, your book, Sisyphus Shrugged, is available on Amazon.
Yes,
and
it is.
Can I get a commitment from you to come back and talk to me about this a little bit more?
Oh, I'd be happy to.
Okay, great. We've kind of run over time, but that's okay. I think we had two really important topics that we covered tonight, and I really appreciate you coming on, Robert, and I really want to have you back on for another show.
I'd be delighted.
Okay, great, fantastic. This has been Short Attention Span Theater with Robert Peet discussing J. Sizemore and Ayn Rand, and we'll pick this up at another time. I'm going to take this out with Dopes to Infinity. So here we go.